My name is Greg Dick. I am the Senior Director of Public Engagement and Advancement here at Perimeter, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this evening's installment of the Perimeter Institute Public Lecture Series. Although we are still socially distanced, we are delighted to welcome Harvard University Professor Dr. Mahadevan, who graciously recorded the talk you're about to see from his home office in Boston. The professor will share how new research in physics and math and biology and other fields are helping scientists understand the incredible diversity of life on Earth. The professor has been named the Guggenheim Fellow, a MacArthur Fellow, and is a Fellow of the Royal Society of London. And tonight, we are excited to have him as a Perimeter Institute public lecturer. Welcome, Professor, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you all for taking the time to be with us virtually, with everybody. It's spring. Plants are blooming, birds are chirping, and it's a reminder of the remarkable diversity of life that surrounds us on this planet. What I want to do today is to tell you a little bit about a specific aspect of this diversity, which is associated with the forms that we see in the world around us, some of which you can essentially see right behind me. The tree, the bird's nest hanging from the tree, the grasses in the background, and so on and so forth. The origin of form, called morphogenesis from the Greek for morphe and genesis, is a very old subject. Aristotle already thought about it 1,000 years ago or so in the context of understanding or asking the question of how form might arise from an egg. And he had an inclination from based on observations that this could indeed happen. If you look outside your window, you will probably see very soon, if this is not already happening, over a period of days, something similar to this video that I borrowed from YouTube, where a seed germinates, and as it germinates, a shoot grows out against gravity towards the sun over a period of days, over a characteristic scale, which can be centimeters, if I'm thinking about grasses, to meters, tens of meters, I'm thinking about entire trees. If you look at a pond nearby, and you had a lens, not too powerful, and you watched the spawning of and fertilization, and then the growth of an egg, in this case, a fish egg, you might be able to see something like this. This, in this case, over a period of hours, where you see a single cell fertilized, an egg fertilized by a sperm, go through this remarkable process whereby it divides multiple times, creates this shape, which will eventually become a fish over a period of about a day or so. So again, this is on the scale of weeks. This is on the scale of a few days. And it's quite a sight to behold. If you had access to a microscope in a high school or a college lab, and now you looked at yet a different organism, in this case, an insect, you can essentially see something even more remarkable, just because on the scale, you can essentially get to view the individual nuclei, which will eventually then separate out into individual cells. And what I'm showing you over here is something that happens now over a period of a few hours, less than that associated with the organization in the form of a fish, much, much less than that for a plant. And this will eventually become a larva, which can crawl away, and eventually, if you allow it to continuously grow, will become a fruit fly. So this is just a small vignette of a set of vignettes associated with form that one can see across the entire tree of life. And it's been the subject of writings by scientists, by poets, drawings by artists for eons. What can we say about it from the point of view of science today? It's worth pointing out something that the famous architect Louis Sullivan said almost a century ago in the context of architecture, when he said that form ever follows function. In biology, you can flip this around and say that function never follows form. And so if we understand form, perhaps we have a sense by which we can also understand function. And that's, of course, also true in engineering. So where are we in the context of trying to make sense of this? 100 years ago or so, a Scottish polymath, Darcy Wentworth Thompson, wrote this very famous book, as famous in literature as it is in science, called On Growth and Form, in which he makes a plea for scientists of all ilks to essentially think about biological form from a mathematical and physical point of view. And in this book, which he says was all introduction, he says, and I quote, "An organism is so complex a thing and growth so complex a phenomena that for growth to be so uniform and constant is unlikely and unusual. Rates vary, proportions change, the whole configuration alters accordingly." In other words, you basically have different parts of the body growing at different rates, cells dividing, cells moving, cells changing their size, cells changing their shape. And a consequence of these fields, you get these remarkable forms. So what matters and what we need to try and understand is how to convert these verbal descriptions to mathematical descriptions to physical descriptions. And of course, we can't do that without having a core, which is biological. And I'm going to try and describe some of that before I switch to a mathematical and physical description. About 50 years ago, the geneticist and developmental biologist Conrad Waddington organized what is now considered to be a very famous set of meetings called Towards a Theoretical Biology, resulting in 3 volumes. And in this set of volumes, he says, no conceptualization of a living system is adequate unless it includes at least 4 importantly different time scales. Those associated with metabolism, those associated with development, what I just showed you in the context of plants and animals, those associated with heredity, and those associated with space. We have to understand how things happen in time. Both are, of course, very familiar to people who think about the physical world, but as shouldn't be surprising to anybody, they are equally relevant in the biological world. In between these books or volumes, there was another very famous paper published by a mathematician whose name should be very familiar to almost everybody over here, Alan Turing, which in about the early 1950s, he wrote a prescient paper called The Chemical Basis for Morphogenesis. What I'm going to do today is to try and give you a complementary perspective, which is more of a mechanical behavior or a perspective associated with the mechanical basis for morphogenesis. So how do we make sense of this? As I said, about 75 years ago, the dawn of molecular biology essentially led to a remarkable set of advances in trying to understand the molecular and the genetic and the signaling basis associated with how life works, understanding how information is stored, how information is propagated biochemically, understanding how signals are moved around in space and time. And eventually, the hope was that we can essentially use that to try and construct an entire framework for how life essentially evolved. So that brings us to the question, how do genes, how do molecules beget geometry? Because form is, at the end of the day, associated with geometry. And there's a problem. Where do you start? Do you start at the level of genes and genetic networks? Do you start at the level of cells and signals associated with cells, how they communicate with each other, next to each other, how they essentially secrete cells which move far away through diffusion, through active transport? Do you start worrying about cell fate, whether they're going to become part of the brain? Are they going to become part of the gut? Are they going to become part of the eyes and so on? Do you worry about their shape? Do you worry about their movement? Do you worry about how they divide, where they divide, how often they divide? And going beyond, do you also think about how much different parts of the body grow, how they push and pull against each other in the context of flows and forces? And the short answer is we have to worry about all of them. Because at the end of the day, if I'm thinking about morphology, which, as I said before, is an antecedent and an enabler and a constrainer of physiology, we need to understand all these different levels, which then lead to geometry and therefore morphology. So we can start at the nanomolecular, nanometric level associated with molecules, micrometric level associated with cells, millimetric and larger associated with tissues. And it's not enough to just think about this as a one-way street. because you can have feedback associated with what's happening on the larger scale to events associated with what's happening on the smaller scale. Feedback associated with chemistry, biochemistry, because molecules can be up or down-regulated. Feedback associated with mechanics, because forces can lead to increase or decrease, for example, in the ability for cells to secrete molecules, for cells to essentially divide, for cells to move, and so on and so forth. And this is a problem which we face in other parts of physics and engineering as well. I'm thinking about, for example, modeling the climate. It isn't enough for me to understand the constituents of matter. It's not enough to just understand the molecular aspects of matter. I have to also coarse grain and think about how that leads to flows on the scale of the entire planet. And so the appropriate level of description is just as much part of asking the question as it is of answering the question. And that is also the case over here. So we need the right kind of coarse grain description to make progress, because if we focus exclusively on what is happening on the smaller scales, we may not be able to essentially traverse all these large scales that at the end we need to. If we focus exclusively on the large scales, we may have to go back and essentially figure out how to build in the feedback associated with very small scales. And in particular, we have to worry about the fact that in biology, unlike in physics, regulation is an extremely important part of the story. The flows and forces don't just lead to shape, but then they feed back in the end to shape itself. So regulation is something that we necessarily need to take into account. If you come from the perspective of biology and are interested in understanding morphogenesis, you're interested in understanding the principles of development, how different organisms became what they are on the scale of one generation, so aspects of developmental biology. If you were thinking about it from a slightly broader perspective, you would also ask the question of how these shapes, how these morphologies evolved over much, much longer periods of time, over, for example, the entire course of multicellular evolution over the last half a billion years or so, and that would, of course, move you towards evolution. If, on the other hand, you were thinking about it from the perspective of mathematics or physics, these comparative studies need to also be go hand in hand with a theoretical description, which might involve models in physics. And by models, I don't necessarily mean mathematical models, I mean physical models, mimics of what might be happening in biology, if not completely, at least partially in physical systems. And I'll introduce those as we go along. And then from the point of view of mathematics, we're interested in metaphor. We're interested in asking how we may be able to jump from a description of one particular organism to another particular organism so that we can try and understand the broad rules of life and therefore understand aspects of both development and evolution. Okay, so how do we do that? So the title of my lecture was Morphogenesis, Geometry, Physics, and Biology. And geometry is part of mathematics, and should start with trying to describe what we see. So a very important aspect of quantifying anything is to first describing it from a mathematical perspective. And I'm going to again start with the quote of Darcy Thompson, said the problems of form are, in the first instance, mathematical problems. And this, of course, is hardly a new realization. It's actually realization that goes back to very famous artists, well before scientists. Albrecht Dürer famously tried to ask the question of how it is possible to try and warp faces from one onto another. And here is a set of lithographs that he essentially created, where he drew a grid on a specific face, and then by warping the individual elements, showed that you could essentially transform one face into another. Darcy Thompson, in his book on growth and form, asked a similar question and had some sketches which weren't quantified in his time. So how can we essentially take advantage of these artistic and somewhat heuristic bases, make them quantitative? We are not limited to working with planar geometries. We have to worry about the fact that shape in three dimensions can be far more complicated. And so we are not limited to Euclidean geometries. We have to worry about non-Euclidean geometries, the kinds of geometries that appear in other parts of physics, such as associated with cosmology and the structure of the universe. Here too, if I'm thinking about biological forms, you may not have situations where the shortest path between two points is a straight line. For example, an apple, that's certainly not the case. and that actually relates to, for example, aspects of the shape of the apple. You also have situations where the parallel line postulate is no longer true, which is essentially the origin of Euclidean geometry. And you have situations associated with cases where the angles of a triangle don't add up 180 degrees. And you can see this, for example, on my head. You can see this on the surface of my brain and so on and so forth. So we have to worry about geometries, which we are familiar with in other aspects of physics, but also now increasingly in biology. Similarly, we may not be limited to either Euclidean or non-Euclidean geometries. We may have to worry about projective geometries, the kind of geometries, again, that artists knew about a long, long time ago in the context of perspective drawings. Here shown as a way to describe the different forms of bird eggs in terms of their asymmetry. So their left-right asymmetry, how conical they are on one side and how blunt they are on the other side, and the ellipticity, how far they are from being a sphere. And this is these are associated with aspects of projective geometry. As we know, for the last 150 or even more, 200 years, there are many different kinds of geometries. I've sketched out a couple of these, which come up again and again in biology. I want to tell you about another one, which again comes up in biology. Of course, it has antecedents in physics and has been used with great power in physics for since the beginning of complex analysis, which is associated with conformal geometry. And to give you an idea, conformal geometry basically asks the following question: how can I take a shape and convert it to another shape from the perspective of preserving all angles, or equivalently by taking the shape, tiling it with small circles, and then the only degree of freedom that you have is to increase or decrease the size of these circles, keeping them as circles. And if you can do that, then the geometry is called conformal. And to show you an illustration of this, what I've done over here is to take a fly wing and essentially map the boundary onto the boundary of a circle, and then the interior maps to the interior. And these points that you can see in different colors correspond to what would happen if I took multiple examples of these wings and mapped their venation patterns associated with the locations where the veins essentially intersected onto their analogs inside this disk. And the fact that you see multiple points shows you that there is individual to individual variability. And so that basically means that this mathematics can be used to do exactly what Dürer, Thompson, and others thought, which is to quantify what we can see qualitatively, differences in shape. It turns out that's not enough to understand the variability in shape. And the reason is because small circles don't have to remain small circles. They can essentially become elliptical. And if they become elliptical, then we have a new kind of geometry that we have to use, which is called quasi-conformal geometry. I've shown you over here an example, or at least in my eyes, an example of how this can be used in clothing design from the cover of The New Yorker, where you see ellipses, and the way in which these ellipses are essentially patterned relative to each other gives rise to very beautiful patterns, in this case on a dress. And you can essentially see what that corresponds to at the scale of an individual element, where I have a bunch of circles. And if I take these circles and convert them to ellipses and change the size and the orientation of the ellipse, I can convert the eye to a C so that you can indeed see what is happening. And in the context of Darcy Thompson's very beautiful sketches, you can convert one fish to another by taking the circles and converting them to ellipses. So what does this essentially allow you to do? So the mathematics is very beautiful. It has existed. It has been used in other parts of science. We can essentially take it and start to build with it ways to describe how variability in shape arises. And the mathematics is elegant, it exists, as I said, so what can we do with it? You can, for example, compare across species. You can look, for example, at different wings from different species, and then look at the positions associated with where the veins intersect and ask where they were transformed using these quasi-conformal or small variant of that called the Teichmuller map. And then you look at the similarity of the maps. So if they all were lying on top of each other, then this final shape will look exactly the same for each one of these different species. And the similarity can then be looked at in terms of this simple square array, where if it's black, then it's perfectly similar. If it's white, they're very dissimilar, and you start to see patterns. Okay? So there's now a mathematical way in which you can try and describe, without understanding necessarily how it came about, you can at least quantify the differences across species. You can also quantify the differences across time in a species as the wing develops. in this case, associated with, I believe, a moth. This is the larval stage. This is the adult stage. I'm afraid these are not drawn to scale. This is not as big as it is over here. It's actually much, much smaller, but it's been drawn this way so you can actually see it. And so the transition occurs when you go from the larval to the prepupal to the pupal to the adult state. And what I've shown you on the right is essentially, again, using these packings of circles, which are converted to ellipses, you can see where most of the activity is occurring in different stages. For example, over here, much of the size change is occurring close to where the wing is attached to the base. Later on, much of the shape change is occurring far from the base, close to the edge of the wing, associated with the fact that the circles became ellipses. Again, I want to emphasize the mathematics allows you to essentially compare across development in one organism over time. That's static. Can you do the same thing? Or can you use mathematics to do something similar dynamically? What are we given? So the remarkable advances in imaging over the last 50 years allow us to essentially watch individual nuclei, watch individual cells, as I showed you at the beginning. And we can ask, how do you essentially use that to try and predict where the cells will end up? Which cells will become part of the wing? Which cells will become part of the body? Which cells will become part of the brain? Which cells will become part of the gut? And so on and so forth. And what I'm showing you over here is a movie from a completely different system. In this case, a chick embryo fairly early in morphogenesis. And you can see these flows, which are vertical, fluid dynamical-like flows. And associated with these vertical flows, you see the formation of a structure called the primitive streak. What's the question over here? Can you predict where the primitive streak will form? Can you predict when the primitive streak will form? Can you even predict if the primitive streak will form? Using what? Using the fact that we have this remarkable data set. Can we not drown in this large amount of data? Can we instead glean from it wisdom? How do we need to do that? How can we do that? From the point of view of mathematics, we need to prescribe or describe or use metrics which are invariant with respect to the fact that I may move my head, I may rotate my head, you may move or rotate the camera. Whatever metric you use shouldn't be dependent on those. It should be capable of predicting these organized structures, like the one that I'm showing you right in the middle over here, if you can see my arrow. And at the end of the day, it should be understandable and easy to implement from the point of view of a computation. How do we do that without getting into the details? The answer is not to look at instantaneous snapshots, not to look at movies like I showed you alone, but to complement both those by basically asking what happens to neighborhoods of individual cells. And if you look to understand what happens to neighborhoods of individual cells, you then get a sense of, do these neighborhoods split apart? Do these neighborhoods come together? So you now know whether or not they're repellers, whether they're attractive. And you can do this in forward time. You can also do this in backward time. If you do this in forward time and they come together, they would correspond to attractors. If you do this in forward time and they're repelling, they would correspond to repellers, and vice versa in backwards time. And so with some analysis, it turns out it's possible to essentially predict. For example, you see over here, this is a calculation based on the trajectories, showing the formation of primitive streak in different settings. This is essentially the same calculation, but now used to depict how relative deformations of these relative motions of these regions essentially lead to the formation of the primitive streak. Not dissimilar to what I'm showing you over here, but now focusing on a dynamical perspective. Okay, so what does this mathematical perspective allow us to essentially do? It gives you a way of comparison. It gives you a quantitative way, therefore, of describing individual variability. It also gives you a way of describing across-species variability. But what does it not do? It doesn't allow for clear predictions because it doesn't have information about the flows and forces that essentially lead to these forms. Instead, it takes an agnostic, mathematical, and very beautiful geometric perspective that allows you to quantify without giving you an underlying mechanism. So how can we do better? So we need now a predictive theory. And what I want to do over the next 20 or so minutes is to give you some flavors of these predictive theories in the context of some specific examples. Okay. Again, I'm going to use Thompson's book, as a motivation. And in this book, he says that cells and tissue are portions of matter, and it is in obedience to the laws of physics that their particles have been moved, molded, and conformed. So how can we essentially make sense of that? As I said at the beginning, there are four different fields associated with what happens at the cellular scale. And I want to coarse grain, I want to zoom out a little bit. I don't want to look at every little detail because that might be too much. It might not be possible to eventually get a view of the entire phenotype, the shape. I want to coarse grain. So what can happen to cells? Cells can change their number, cells can change their size, cells can change their shape, and cells can change their position. And each one of these quantities can happen as a function of space, and it can happen as a function of time. Here's an example of how cell number change can lead to shape. This is a normal snapdragon leaf. I'll show you a snapdragon flower in a little while. And there are mutants, which you can use to induce growth along the edge. And if you induce growth along the edge relative to the center, shown over here using a marker, it turns out that that edge, when it grows much more than the center, the snapdragon leaf switches and looks like a potato chip. And in fact, it's not an accident, it looks like a potato chip, because that's essentially why a potato chip also has edges which are crinkled. You take a slice of a potato, you dip it in hot oil, the outside is where you lose water earliest, the outside starts to become stiff, then the inside starts to shrink, and if the inside starts to shrink and the outside is already frozen, it's equivalent to the outside growing relative to the inside. And so the potato chip has the shape that it does, as does the snapdragon leaf. And that, in fact, is the verbal description of a mathematical framework, which I will illustrate in a couple of minutes to show you how you can understand the space of potential shapes. If you have cell size change, you can also change overall shape. These are images of what happens to a particular bone in our body during adolescence. So we all know that during adolescence, relative proportions of different parts of our body, our limbs in particular, change enormously. How does that happen? That happens because cells hypertrophy, they increase their size. Where does that happen? That happens typically in between joints. It doesn't happen at the joints, it happens in between joints. And of course, that leads to elongated limbs, arms and legs. So that's now driven by cell size change. You can also have cell shape change. So if I had a bunch of circular cells, which is in plant form, and they start becoming elongated and kept their location relative to each other the same, that elongation of the cells will essentially lead to an elongation of the organ. And that's very beautifully seen, for example, in a set of flowers, which are closely related to each other. And the only difference is that the cell shape changes. And when the cell shape changes, you can have either long nectar spurs or short bulbous nectar spurs. Or finally, in the animal world, in plants, you can have these three: cell number, size, and shape change. In the animal world, cells can also change their relative position. So they can essentially move. And when they move, again, you can have cells which come together at one location and move apart. And when they come together at one location, move apart, a square object will become an elongate object. So we need to understand these four fields as a function of space and time. And if we can do that, then we can start to make sense at this coarse grain level of how you can get form. And I'm going to give you four examples of how this might be achieved in the context of plants first, in the context of a shoot, something similar to what might be growing inside your home or in the garden outside, switching from this one-dimensional object, a shoot-like object, to a leaf-like object or a leaf itself. And I'm going to ask, why is the edge rippled, and can you make sense of that? So two-dimensional, and then I'll switch to animals and ask whether there are similar principles which we can use to understand the morphogenesis of shape in animals. And I'm going to think about the gut. This is the gut of a chick a few days after it's been fertilized. And then finally, this is somewhere in between two and three dimensions. And then finally, I will switch to three dimensions, and I'll focus on the shape of our brain. And of course, this is fully three-dimensional, okay? What's the difficulty compared to what I was showing you from the point of view of description? From the point of view of prediction, the difficulty will be that if I have physical theories and I have these theories which depend on parameters, then we have to measure them. And sometimes the number of parameters is not small, and that's problematic, and problematic in a very particular way, because it might not be that you have enough predictions. You may have more parameters and predictions, which would be a tragedy. The advantage, of course, is that you have experiments to try and test that. We want to make sure that we are not in the somewhere in between, Scylla and Charybdis. We want to make sure, as George Box, the statistician, famously said, he said famously about all models, that all models are wrong, some are useful. And we hope to construct models which are useful. And we want to make sure that we're not in a situation where there are so many parameters that the rejoinder to Box, and I don't know who was responsible for this, as someone famously said, all models are right, most are useless. And of course, the fact that they're useless is because they have too many parameters. So you've got to minimize the number of parameters to make predictions which are testable and meaningful and generalizable, not just for that particular example, but also across a broader set of examples, which goes well beyond the example studied. And this is where perhaps mathematics and physics essentially has an important role to play. Okay, so I want to start with the form and the growth of shoots. And here are some pictures, taken a few years ago from inside our house with houseplants. So we've seen, if you have, for example, a plant that by accident had a shoot which was growing horizontally, shoots don't like to grow with gravity, they like to grow against gravity. They also like to grow towards the sun. In this case, these experiments were done at night, so the sun plays no role, which gravity is downwards, started out horizontally, turned around, and became vertical. It's what's called negatively gravitropic. That's one example. Another example is a situation where the shoot started to grow downwards and then somehow decided that's wrong. Not somehow, we know how it decided that. It's gravitropic. I'll tell you exactly how that happens. And then it starts to turn around and start moving upwards. Or it never is able to move upwards at all, moves downwards. You ask, well, is there a method to this madness? Why is it that some of these shoots grow up, some go down before they go up, some go down completely? And this is hardly a new question. Many people have thought about this for hundreds of years, and I want to now provide a framework using words which can be converted to mathematics, although I will not show you mathematical formalism, I'll just show you the results. Okay, so we need some facts. So plants don't grow everywhere. Shoots in particular have what's called a growth zone, and the growth zone is limited to the tips. So it's limited to a neighborhood of the tip, which doesn't extend all the way. It's not tiny, it's not very large, it's somewhere in between. Second thing is, in that growth zone, plants are what are called gravitropic. So they have the ability to sense the direction of gravity and then move against it if they are shoots and move towards it if they are roots. And you ask, how does that happen? And in a nutshell, individual plant cells have tiny particles called amyloplasts, so starch granules, and these starch granules settle under the influence of gravity. And when they settle, that settling can lead to essentially an interaction with sensors inside the cell. And depending on where they settle, you can clearly see it will give you a sense in which direction gravity is acting. So that's a cellular level signal, but that cellular level signal has to be integrated across multiple cells and lead to a process associated with how the shoot grows. Okay, there's also a phototropic aspect, but I won't talk about the phototropic aspect today, which is associated with moving towards the sun. I only talk about gravitropism, and I talk about gravitropism in the context of shoot growth, because that's associated with this set of examples over here. So here is a cartoon of what would happen if the shoot was originally growing horizontally, and then it turned and became vertical. And I want to now imagine a thought experiment where light is coming from above. This is the shoot, which is trying to move towards against gravity. Sorry, not light. Gravity, excuse me, is pointing downwards. I have a mistake in one of the slides in one of the figures in a minute. Gravity is pointing downwards. The shoot is going upward. If the shoot goes upwards, the first part, which becomes perpendicular and against gravity, will be the tip. But this part still hasn't become vertical, and this part still is growing. So if the tip has essentially become vertical and this part has not yet become vertical, this part wants to become vertical, and so it wants to become vertical. But if that becomes vertical, this part is no longer vertical. And if that's the case, then this part wants to become vertical, so it will start to turn. And so what's going to happen is that the shoot is essentially going to oscillate. It's going to give rise to what are called hunting oscillations. And you've seen this in situations where if you don't have perfect control over the steering wheel and you're trying to go in a straight line, you may overcorrect and then undercorrect. For example, either because you don't have control over the steering wheel or the wheels don't have good traction with the ground on a snowy or an icy day. And so you start to oscillate. And that's exactly what would happen if, in fact, that was the mechanism at play. The only thing that was essentially happening was the ability of the chute to sense gravity. Okay, so this should have been, this is wrong. It should have been sunlight. It's gravity. It's pointing downwards. But as I said, that would give rise to oscillations, and you don't see oscillations at all. And it would also be extremely susceptible to noise. So what happens instead? And a few years ago, researchers discovered that, in fact, you don't only have gravitropism. Plants also have a measure of their own posture. So they like to be as straight as possible. And it's the same mechanism associated with ameloplasts, which we now believe is responsible for that. So they have a way to essentially measure their own posture. And if they have a way to measure their own posture, that means they want to try and be as straight as possible, but they also want to try and grow as much as possible against gravity. A combination of gravitropism, so sensing gravity and their own posture, coupled with postural correction, might then be a way to essentially make progress. And experiments have shown that this suggestion is not just a suggestion, it is in fact valid experimentally. And from there, one can essentially construct a theoretical framework, which is a function of how sensitive you are to the direction of gravity and how sensitive you are to your own posture. If you're extremely sensitive to gravity and not very much to posture, then you would essentially get, for example, a shape, which I'm showing you over here. If, on the other hand, your weight is very large, so you want to try and grow, but just because as you're growing, you become heavy, you start to sag, and yet you still want to try and grow against gravity, then you might see a shape like this. So not dissimilar to this. This is not dissimilar to that. And if you're somewhere in between, then you essentially can get shapes of this kind. And together, you can use this to construct a framework which addresses this question of the method to the madness. It's not that plants do this or this or this on a whim. It's that there are a couple of parameters, the parameters associated with how heavy the plant is relative to its sensitivity to growth. And as a function of these parameters, as you vary them, you can get shapes which correspond to, for example, in this region over here, where the plant just grows vertically as quickly as possible, while over here it's oscillating. So in this case, it's not very sensitive to its posture and it's oscillating. Over here, it's extremely sensitive to its posture, and so it doesn't want to oscillate. If it's extremely heavy, so you're somewhere over here, so gravity is large, and you want to grow up vertically, but you can't, and so you essentially sag downwards. So what has physics done? Physics is essentially, and mathematics done, it's taken these very beautiful experimental observations and coarse-grained appropriately so that you're not zooming in and looking at every cell, you are looking at the entire chute, and you are describing a set of rules associated with gravitropism for which there is experimental, substantial experimental basis, postural sensing for which there is an experimental basis, to provide a feedback or a regulatory scheme. So as I said at the beginning, what is remarkable about biology in particular relative to physics is, if I'm thinking about morphology, is that you have growth, you have shape, and then you have feedback between them. So you have some way of regulating it. And this regulation described here verbally gives rise to this morphospace. In this one-dimensional example, can we ask a similar question now for leaves? Okay, why do leaves ripple? And how do they ripple? Why is a much harder question. I will not address this now. I'm happy to take questions at the end. If I now consider a different species, in this case, the Asian lily leaf, you see that it's curved in two directions, very beautiful. But if you take a razor blade and cut it, and one of the wonderful things about working with plants is that nobody complains if you essentially do surgery on them, you cut it along the main vein or the midrib, and you find that all these ripples straighten out. And furthermore, the central vein, the midrib, also straightens out. Okay, why is that? Because turns out that what's happening is that different parts of the leaf are growing different amounts. And if you relax them, if you allow them to essentially completely be relaxed when we cut them, then they all flatten out. But when you put them together, different parts have to be compressed or stretched. And as a consequence of that, you get the shape. So we understand that the shape of the leaf is because different parts are growing a little to each other, exactly like what I showed you in the snap track. And you can do a physical experiment, which I invite you to do, with a piece of foam where you take a thin rectangular foam and you drag your nails across the edge gently. And when you do so, you'll get a shape which is no longer flat, and you drag them with a lot of pressure and quite strongly, you'll get something which looks like a ripple. Why? Because you've stretched the edges compared to the center over here a little bit. And if the edges are stretched, naturally you'll expect to get a saddle. And if the edges are stretched a lot, you get something which is multiple saddles, something which is a ripple. So exactly the same over here. This is a physical model. Can you construct a mathematical model of this? And I'll show you the result in a minute. But first, I want to emphasize that shape over here is a consequence of the frustration associated with different parts wanting to do different things, in this case, have different lengths or different angles, but they're sitting in three dimension, and the consequence of that is this two-dimensional object starts to essentially warp out of the plane. So that's a mathematical principle, and that mathematical principle is based on these physical experiments and these biological observations, and can be used just like in the context of the shoot to construct an analogous morphospace, where one axis is the width of this leaf or leaf-like structure relative to the length, and the other axis is how much the edge is growing compared to the center. So if the edge is not growing at all, it's fairly flat. If the edge is growing a lot, it becomes rippled, and in between, you essentially get these saddle-like shapes, exactly like what I've shown over here. And these lines correspond to calculations that are associated with the framework that takes these verbal descriptions and converts them to a tiny bit of mathematics. Okay, can we go beyond leaves? And for inspiration, we may want to look at a remarkable artist, writer, philosopher, Goethe, who wrote a book called Metamorphosen, in which he essentially articulates what he thought about the remarkable transformations and shapes that he saw, particularly in the plant world. Where he also talked about the fact that petals are modified leaves. He thought about this based on observations. We now know that is not so far from the truth from a biological perspective, even when you go and look at what's happening on the cellular scale. Of course, there are differences as well. And can we take inspiration from that to ask a question that has been an inspiration for many artists, for many painters, for many poets, but surprisingly few scientists. How does the lily bloom? And I want to first show you a time-lapse video of the Asian lily flower now over the last few hours associated with blooming. And you saw the petals were closed. They were actually surrounded by sepals as well before that, but I didn't show that to you. We pulled them off. And then these petals essentially bloomed. And when they bloomed, they switched from being convex to being in one direction convex, another direction concave, as you can clearly see. And you can also, I hope, see that the edges of these flowers are rippled, not dissimilarly to what you can actually see in the leaf itself. So that, I've already sensitized you to it, that should suggest that in fact, blooming might not occur because the center, the midrib, is essentially causing the flower to bloom. It may be because the edges are rippled. And in fact, again, you can do surgical experiments and you can measure how much the edges grow relative to the center. So measure how much these edges grow relative to the center. You take a ballpoint pen or an ink pen and you put dots on the boundary and you watch how quickly they move apart compared to what would happen if you put these dots along the center. And you find that along the periphery, they move apart much more, exactly like what happens in the leaf. Therefore, the edges are essentially growing relative to the center. And if the edges are growing relative to the interior, again, you have frustration, and that frustration leads to a change in shape. Again, you can construct a framework from that, or you can complement that using a computation. And I want to show you a simple computation associated with what would happen to a single leaf. It started out with one shape, convex, and as the edge grows, it flipped, and it also started to ripple. Okay. So where does this essentially take us? So we went from this one-dimensional problem of a growing shoot to the two-dimensional problem for a leaf. And from a mathematical, from a physics perspective, as I said, the hope is always that what we do is not limited to that specific example, but can be essentially perhaps deployed more generally. Of course, you've got to be careful. You don't want the theory off. You don't have theory necessarily want to be so ambitious and aim for a theory for everything, but certainly we want a theory off specific examples one at a time. So rather than a theory off everything, we want a theory for everything. I didn't get that right first time. Okay. Can you essentially take this idea and deploy it elsewhere? And the answer is yes. We'll be very careful that we don't think the whole world is a nail looking to be hammered by that specific hammer that I have in my hand, but I've chosen my examples carefully where it does work. Completely switching now from the plant world to the animal world. Here I want to show you a chick embryo. This is the forebrain. This is what will eventually become the spinal cord. And the organ under consideration is the gut. For you and for me, the gut is 7 or 8 meters long, and it's fairly well packed, hopefully remains well packed and doesn't start to bulge out over time. In the chick, something similar, not nearly as long. A few days after hatching, it's about 7 millimeters long. The chick hatches, a few days after fertilization, it's about 7 millimeters long. Before hatching, chick hatches about 21 days after the egg has been fertilized. This is about 15 days after it's been fertilized. The egg, the length of the gut has increased from 7 millimeters to more than 20 times, 170 millimeters long. And the shape has changed remarkably. Instead of the shape being a simple tube, which lies in the mid-sagittal plane, the shape has this coiled, loopy form. That is the gut. This is one of the main arteries called the supramesenteric artery. And this diaphanous membrane is what is called the mesentery. It essentially attaches the gut to the body. So how does this happen? Turns out this is very reproducible. And again, one can ask, are there genetic mechanisms? And people looked for the genetic mechanisms, didn't find any. Are there very small scale mechanisms associated with the fact that over here, the gut is growing faster compared to here, and therefore it bends one direction. And over here, this part is growing slower than that or less than that and bending the other direction and so on. Or is there a much simpler principle? Is there a master puppeteer understanding and measuring and then regulating everything, or is there a much coarser view? So how might one understand that? Again, you can resort to these experiments, this not dissimilar to the surgical experiments that I showed you with the leaf. And if you separate the gut from the mesentery, something interesting happens. The gut completely straightens out while the mesentery shrinks. So now, having sensitized you to the leaf problem, you can see it's essentially the same thing. Completely different organism, very different molecular ingredients, and yet the same principle from a mathematical and physical point of view. Namely, that the gut itself you can think about as the edge of this mesentery, except it's a tube. And if that tube grows relative to the interior, then the tube is going to be put into compression because the mesentery, which is like the interior of the leaf, wants to pull it in. And therefore, it's going to start to coil, it's going to start to buckle. So that differential growth between the gut and the mesentery gives rise to looping, okay? And indeed, when you essentially cut just the mesenteric artery, you see that the gut has this characteristic view where it loops first in one direction, then the opposite direction, one direction, and the opposite direction. Okay, so this is now inspiration to build a physical model, and this is indeed a physical model of that where we took a rubber sheet, you stretch it out, you take a rubber tube, you stitch it to the end of the rubber sheet, and after you stitch it, you let it go. That sheet, when it was stretched out, and you let it go, it's compressed, is the mesentery, or the analog of the mesentery. The gut, remember, is put into compression, or the tube is put into compression because it's growing much faster than the mesentery. Over here, it's put into compression because you stitched it to the stretched sheet. And a consequence of this, we get exactly the same shape, okay? One very important thing to notice is why do you get these loops of opposite chirality? So they're first going clockwise for a while, then they're going anti-clockwise, then clockwise and anti-clockwise. And the answer to that is because they're connected to the body by the mesentery, or equivalently, the sheet is not allowed to do funny things far away. And so that leads to a very beautiful connection to topology, because that prevents the gut from essentially twisting on itself. And sometimes that can happen, and it's called gut volvulus, and it can be quite nasty and unpleasant. It can happen locally when the gut twists itself, can't happen globally. Taking that into account, one can construct a mathematical framework, and that mathematical framework, in fact, you can use to do a computation, and I'm showing you the results over here. Okay. I told you that when you see something in one place, often all of us have the tendency to see everywhere. And so this is actually an actual model found on a window in the window of a very fancy couturier in Paris when I was visiting a few years ago, and costs an arm and a leg. I can't quite remember the numbers. Same principle. Over here, a piece of wire stitched elegantly to form a stole, which has the same shape as the gut. These experiment costs a couple of dollars. These probably three orders of magnitude more than that. Okay. Artists, of course, get there first. Scientists gradually crawl along and eventually get there, we hope. You can essentially take these ideas and construct a framework to measure quantitatively what happens in the egg, what happens with rubber, what happens when you do a computation, and what happens when you essentially do a pen and paper calculation, and you can see that they all coincide. You can do this in one organism over time in the context of the chick. You can do this across organisms where you can compare the chick with the quail. The quail is much smaller. The quail egg is much smaller. It's still a bird. The finch, a favorite of evolution biologists, and the mouse, completely different animal, not a bird, a mammal. And all these essentially provide the same provide data, and they fall on the same line, suggesting that these mathematical and physical principles appropriately coarse grain, not thinking about the individual molecules, not thinking about what happens at the individual cell level, but appropriately coarse grain, provide predictive ways of understanding these patterns. And then you can go back and ask, as I said, it's not enough to just focus on what happens on the large scale. You have to ask what controls relative growth. And turns out that you can essentially vary the amount of growth between the mesentery and the gut. And when you do that, for example, if you have much stronger differential growth, it turns out that you get much tighter patterns and much weaker differential growth. So the mesentery is actually able to keep up with the gut, then you get much coarser patterns using specific molecules, BMP2 and noggin. And you can show that, in fact, this now makes sense in the context of these large-scale predictions and provides, if you will, molecular teeth, which tell you how, by varying these parameters, we can essentially vary gut form. Why is this interesting? It's interesting because it raises a question to which we don't yet have an answer, which is, from an evolutionary point of view, why are there so many gut patterns? These are images from a book published more than 100 years ago by Mitchell, where he shows different gut patterns associated with different birds. And these gut patterns are hypothesized to be associated with different diets. Carnivorous diets typically are associated with short guts. Herbivorous diets are typically associated with long guts because the time of transit is associated with how quickly you can extract nutrients. And of course, with carnivorous diets, you can essentially extract nutrients very quickly. And a short gut is advantageous because a gut is a very expensive tissue to maintain because the inside is renewed very, very frequently. So why am I telling you all this? I'm telling you all this because there is a chance, we're not there yet, there's a chance that if we understand these molecular controls, perhaps we might be able to start making sense of, are these or are other such molecular controls associated with differential growth, allowing us to describe the range of gut patterns. So converting this original perspective, which was very molecular, to a macroscopic perspective, and then coming back to the molecular and starting to close the loop. don't have an answer yet, but perhaps we've at least been able to sharpen the question. Very quickly, I have about 5 minutes or so. I wanted to show you what happens inside the gut. So inside the gut, the same principle. The gut starts out as a simple tube. The tube develops ridges. These ridges develop zigzags, and these zigzags eventually form villi. You can construct exactly an analogous theory for that as well, mathematically, which I'm showing you over here, to reflect what happens biologically. We live in three dimensions, and it turns out that there are three timed muscle layers. First, a muscle layer which constrains the gut azimuthally, so prevents it from growing in this direction, so forms ridges. Then a longitudinal muscle layer, which prevents the gut from growing in this direction, and these ridges become zigzags. And then finally, one more azimuthal layer, which causes the gut to essentially grow radially. Three broken symmetries, three timed muscle layers, and you transition from a smooth to a ridged to a zigzag to a vilified gut, if you will. And it's very satisfying that this very simple mathematical, physical, mechanical theory allows you to try and allows you to explain this in a species and across organisms. When you have only two muscle layers, you'll usually get only zigzags. When you get all three, but they happen more or less simultaneously, it's hard to distinguish between them, which happens, for example, in the mouse. Do you see these patterns elsewhere associated with folding? I can't help but show the maple leaf. I wish I was there in person. Very beautiful work, similar in spirit to what I was just showing you, shows why the maple leaf has the shape that it does. It's because when the bud grows, when the leaf is growing inside the bud, depending on the number of folds there are, you are allowed to grow and form, you will be allowed to grow and form a number of points. If it's folded very simply, you just get a single apex. If it's folded threefold, you get three apices. If it's five-folded, you get something which I don't have to tell you about, very, very familiar to you. And these same patterns arise elsewhere. They arise when you essentially have jello, which is drying. They arise in insect wings. They arise in leaves. And they also arise, turns out, in origami, a topic for a different talk altogether. Okay. Last bit, switching out of the third dimension, thinking about cortical convolutions, the folds in our brain, which along with double helix of the DNA, exemplify the complexity and the beauty simultaneously that biology brings to everybody. Okay, so here is a set of images associated with folded brains. Mouse brains are not folded. Human brains are remarkably folded. Whales and elephants also have remarkably folded brains. Folded brains are not unusual. In us, the folding starts around week 20 or so following conception. It continues after birth for almost a year and a half or so until it eventually saturates. And the vertical axis is gyrification index, which is the amount of area of the brain, including all the folds, divided by the area of the brain if I just had a convex hull, so just the smoothed out part. And so the fact that it's greater than one means it's much, much more strongly folded than if it was smooth. And why is this interesting? From a functional consequence, folded cortex maximizes the amount of cortical connectivity while minimizing the wiring length, because you can have different parts connected to each other by basically having it folded in a small volume. If I flattened it out, these wires would have to be very, very long. And therefore, you can process information faster because the wiring length is certainly a constraint on how quickly you can transmit information. So there's an important functional consequence associated with the folded cortex, not just because it's morphologically interesting. What are the origins? People used to think it's associated with the fact that it's sitting inside our cranium. Short answer is no. The experiments done to verify that are gruesome, and I will not describe them. Turns out that there are internal constraints, and the internal constraints are associated with the fact that the gray matter, the cortex, grows relative to the white matter. And so if you have a surface which is growing relative to the bulk and connected to it, then it's going to tend to go into a wrinkled state. And so we did some experiments to essentially try and mimic that physical model, if you will. Take a gel hemisphere, put it in a solvent. It absorbs solvent from the surroundings. It swells And when it swells, it forms wrinkles, not dissimilar to what would happen. You put your fingers in water for too long. Here is a movie showing exactly that. I will speed it up. And you can see this is a computation which shows you how these folds form. You can also see the same thing by basically taking this gel and putting it in a solvent. Okay. Can you use this, finally moving towards humans, to understand human fetal brain development? The answer is yes. This is a set of images associated with what happens during human fetal development. GW is gestation week. By the time the baby is born, it's not quite folded completely, but well on its way. To mimic this, one can essentially create a 3D printed model of this brain, of the human fetal brain, use that to create a gel brain and a cortex, by painting on it a thin polymer layer, which can essentially swell much more easily compared to the bulk. Put this in a solvent, and this is the shape that you get. And here is a movie of what happens over a period of a few hours, reducing what would happen in 10 weeks to 10 minutes in a dish. This is not to say that we understand everything about how the brain folds, but it is to say that folding arises because of this very simple mechanism associated with one part of the brain growing relative to the other part. And also the gel brain, you can't go very far because you can't increase its size a whole lot. You can only increase the surface compared to the bulk. And again, like I showed you in the context of these examples from the plant and from the gut, you can also ask about how these brain shapes change as you go from one species to another, and as a function of the relative expansion of the cortex compared to the white matter, you can essentially get smooth brains becoming more and more folded, approaching the human, again, computationally. And finally, you can also make sense of pathologies associated with brain folding, which also have functional consequences, such as polymicrogyria and pachygyria. In one case, you have thick folds, in the other case, you have very fine folds. And then finally, you also have something called lissencephalia, which you see, for example, in Zika patients, where the brain doesn't fold at all. And that's because the brain is not growing very much and the cortex is relatively thick. And the consequence of both is that you don't get these folds at all. So there are functional consequences of all these. All right. You see these patterns elsewhere. And there's a very beautiful connection to a problem that John Nash, the famous mathematician, famously solved in the 1960s, asking what kinds of surfaces you can essentially smoothly deform in various dimensions. I won't get into that. But I want to close by basically asking where we are. So the forward problem, given growth patterns, can we predict morphology? I think we can make some sense of. Turning it backwards from morphology to growth, we are starting to get a sense of it. The inverse problem, can you design growth patterns given the desired morphology? So how do I go from a flat sheet to a face? How do I go from a flat sheet to a flower? Much, much harder problem. Of course, that's the problem that biology has solved. That's the problem that biology has solved in organisms. It's also solved evolutionally. And it's of interest from a mathematical point of view because it can enable advances, for example, in technology. And I want to show you two examples of this, computational examples of this, how to essentially take a cylinder and grow a flower. This is a snapdragon flower. I showed you the leaf before. If you've recognized this person, fantastic. If you haven't, I will wait for somebody to ask the question at the end. This is asking how to take a flat sheet and essentially convert it to a shape by growing different parts of it. And by growing different parts of it, it deforms out of the plane. Okay, where are we? I've told you that mathematics helps us to quantify patterns in biology. And that can lead potentially to a layered understanding. It's phenomenological in that it describes the patterns, which is not predictive or molecular. And then physics allows you to essentially make predictive advances, again, without being molecular, and asks whether or not these parameters associated with growth are under molecular or under evolutionary and environmental control. I said that there was this remarkable advance due to Alan Turing in the early 50s, where he wrote this beautiful, very prescient paper called Chemical Basis for Morphogenesis. And I hope that I have excited you a little bit towards a complementary perspective, which takes a geometrical and a physical perspective of morphogenesis, which involves a remarkable number of people now working in the area. None of this would have been possible without a remarkable set of collaborators and colleagues, students and postdocs who worked with me, you know, over the years. Their names are over here. A colleague that I've worked with over the years listed also over here. And I'm eternally grateful to all of them for being able to make together these small advances in the field. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Professor. That was wonderful. Thank you for bringing the life sciences and art into our physics realm. Really appreciate that. And thank you to all of you for watching. We hope that you'll join us for our final lecture of the season, which is next Wednesday, May 12th, featuring Dr. Emily Real of Johns Hopkins University. Subscribe to the channel and follow Perimeter on social media to stay up to date on that lecture and, of course, on other events. Stay safe, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.